I'd like to go ahead and call the afternoon session of the Senate Finance Committee to order September 8th, 2021. With me is Senator Bishop, Senator Hoffman, and online, I don't see any other members yet, so we don't have a quorum.
Mr. Chairman, it's Senator Olson here, a gnome, okay, online.
Okay, Senator Olson online.
Yes, Senator Wilikowski online.
And Senator, I had the wrong button pushed, sorry. So we have five of us. Okay, with that, we're going to start a presentation this afternoon. We have two of them. We're going to start with the laws of the permanent fund. Ms. Emily Newman, Deputy Director of Legislative Legal, is going to present. She has about a half hour or a little bit short of that. And then after that, we're going to go into some historical, they might be hysterical when we look at them, scenarios of the permanent fund, looking back in history and to see what it would look like if we had followed the constitutional mandates. With that, Ms. Emily Newman, could you introduce yourself for the record and then take us through your presentation?
I'm getting quite a bit of feedback on my end. Is that just me?
Delayed.
Yep, we'll have a brief at ease.
TV up here in Nome, as well as the
We'll come back on the record. Sorry for the interruption. We had a little bit of feedback. So, Ms. Newman, can you introduce yourself for the record and take us through the presentation, please?
Sure. For the record, my name is Emily Nauman, and I am Deputy Director of Legislative Legal Services. As the committee probably knows, but for the audience listening at home, the Division of Legal Services provides bill drafting services, legal advice, and opinions. They left the legislature. We're a nonpartisan agency of the Legislative Affairs Agency. The presentation today is a shortened presentation of a presentation I gave to the Permanent Fund Working Group in 2019. The 2019 presentation was longer, perhaps a bit drier because it contained more history, but definitely had more jokes than I'll have today. And it also contained a longer discussion of the eligibility requirements, which I had a feeling the legislature wasn't interested in hearing about at this time. I believe that is available in the legislative archives, and I would encourage anyone interested in an in-depth discussion of the history of the the permanent fund statutes to review that presentation. If we could go to the next slide. This presentation is going to focus on three primary areas. It's going to start with a discussion of the Constitution of the State of Alaska. This is really the most important law related to the permanent fund. We're then going to move on to a discussion of AS 3713 and the permanent fund statutes in that section of law, and finally end with a discussion of AS 4323. The permanent fund statutes are really broken up into two sections of law, and so I believe for the 2019 presentation, I prepared a teal book that had all of the statutes together. Now that there's been some changes to the statutes, I'm looking forward to preparing a new one of those so we can have all of the permanent fund statutes together in one set. And I'm sure you'll be seeing that starting again in January. And I'll hopefully have some time at the end for questions. You can move on to the next slide. What we're looking at here is the complete text of Article 9, Section 15. Article 9, Section 15 creates the permanent fund and sets out the constitutional constraints for the use of the principal and income. We can drill this down to three basic points. Next slide. So, first, at least 25% of all mineral revenues received by the state must be placed in the permanent fund. This is the minimum amount of mineral revenues that must be placed in the permanent fund. Second, the principal of the permanent fund shall be only used for income-producing investments. In other words, the principal of the permanent fund cannot be used for appropriations. And finally, third, all income of the permanent fund shall be deposited into the general fund unless otherwise provided by law. So let's jump into the law. Next slide. The first set of statutes, as I mentioned, we'll talk about is AS 3713, so we can jump to the next slide. I can't quite see the slides, but I'm hoping that you're looking at the complete text of AS 3713010. And we can, again, click through this slide. I just wanted to give you an idea of what this statute looked like. Hopefully now you're looking at the principal concept slide of AS 3713010. So this really contains two principal concepts. First of all, it mirrors the Constitution and requires that all leases entered into before essentially 1980, that 25% of those mineral revenues get deposited into the permanent fund. 010A also has a second provision for leases entered into after 1980 or on or after 1980 that states that 50% of the mineral revenue shall be deposited into the permanent fund. As we'll discuss a little bit later, this additional 25% is not constitutionally necessary, and therefore the legislature may appropriate that additional 25% if it wishes to comply with the statute, but they're not required to by the law. We can see this again when we review the Constitution at the bottom there, which requires 25% of mineral revenues to be deposited into the permanent fund. On to the next slide. We'll just jump right into 020. 3713020 lays out the principle or the findings for the permanent fund itself. And it states, the legislature finds with respect to the permanent fund that the permanent fund should provide a means of conserving a portion of the state's revenue from mineral resources to benefit all generations of Alaskans. Two, the permanent fund's goal should be to maintain the safety of the principal while maximizing the total return. And three, the permanent fund should be used as a savings device managed to allow the maximum use of disposable income from the fund for the purposes designated by the law. This statute was enacted in 1980. As you'll see, that was sort of when the initial regime of permanent fund laws was put into place and has changed very little since it was adopted. We move on to the next slide. 3713030 states that the purpose of the remainder of the sections of 3713 are to provide a mechanism for the management and investment of the permanent fund assets by the Permanent Fund Corporation, and importantly, in a manner consistent with the findings in 020. We can go on to the next slide. There's a kind of a chunk of 3713 that I have a feeling the committee is not particularly interested in hearing about today. Those relate to the Permanent Fund Corporation itself, structure, voting, quorum requirements, and investment responsibilities. It's a little more nitpicky, and I could refer you to those statutes. There's a list of them here in case you're interested. I'm happy to have a discussion with anyone who's interested about those statutes later, but in the interest of time, I thought I would breeze by them today. If we go to the next slide, the first law that is extremely important to consider is 3713140. Hopefully in this slide, you're looking at the complete text of 3713140. We're going to drill down and make this a little more readable. So if we click to the next slide, there are two principal concepts in 3713140A. First, 3713140A sets out how to calculate net income. As we saw in the Constitution, the net income of the fund is deposited in the general fund or another fund as provided by law. This statute helps the corporation and the Department of Revenue determine what is net income, in other words, what gets pulled off the permanent fund and is available for appropriation by the legislature. Second, 3713140A sets out the income available for distribution. This is the first important calculation made for the purpose of determining the dividend and the amount that can be drawn statutorily out of the ERA every year. So the income available for distribution is 21% of the net income of the fund for the last 5 years fiscal years, including the fiscal year just ended. This calculation is the basis of the historical, we call the historical dividend calculation, which we'll get into in a few minutes, but it lives in 140B, 140A. If we can click forward to the next slide, we'll say that when I was assigned these permanent fund statutes, my head spun a little when I tried to figure out how they all interacted together. And the first thing that I did was created a flowchart. And this flowchart lives tacked onto my computer, and I thought it might be helpful to share with the committee. So let's start putting these statutes together in a visual format. We could think of the blue bubble as the constitutional requirements, the minimum constitutional requirements of the permanent fund, right? So we have the permanent fund, we have the income of the fund, and as we'll talk about in a few minutes, the ERA lives inside the permanent fund. But this is a very basic structure set up by the Constitution. What we've just added is 140A, this calculation of income available for distribution. As I said, it's 21% of the net income of the permanent fund for the last average for the last five fiscal years. So now it's time to move on to 140B. On the next slide. 140B introduces another calculation, and I should say 140B was the result of SB 26, as it's commonly known, and sort of introduced a second concept into the amount of money that the legislature would consider available for appropriation every year off the permanent fund. So 140B sets out the amount available for appropriation each year. The amount available for appropriation is 5% of the average market value of the fund for the first five of the preceding six fiscal years, including the fiscal year just ended. An important note here is that for the first 3 years that 140B was in effect, this number was 5.25%, and just very recently, July 1st, 2021, dropped down to 5%. So we can go back to the flowchart on the next slide. Here's another calculation we can add in. Out of the ERA, the legislature also has the option of drawing the amount available for appropriation, which, as we discussed, is 5% of the average market value of the fund for the last five fiscal years. We can move on to 145. 3713-145. Establishes the earnings reserve account. As we saw, the earnings reserve account is within the permanent fund and is the repository for income of the fund that's drawn off every year and available for appropriation. 145B also contains part of the historical, call it old, like the 1980s dividend calculation, and it says that at the end of each fiscal year, the corporation shall transfer from the earnings reserve account to the dividend fund 50% of the income available for distribution under 140B. So let's go back and add something into our chart. Taking the older formula at the top, that's 21% of the net income available for appropriation, we multiply that by 50%, and under 145B, we get the amount transferred to the dividend fund. 145B, the excitement doesn't stop there. Newer to 145 is C. C is a historical calculation, so let's jump to the next slide. But C is the inflation proofing statute. So it says that after the transfer under B, which is for the dividend, and the appropriation under E, which we'll see is the appropriation potential to the general fund, the corporation shall transfer from the earnings reserve to the principal of the fund the amount sufficient to offset the effect of inflation on the principal of the fund during that fiscal year. The remainder of 145C sets out the calculation of that inflation. Like all of the other appropriations set out in statute, this is also not constitutionally mandatory, so it's not required that the legislature make these appropriations each year, and it's my understanding the legislature has not made this appropriation in the past. So we can add one more thing to our flowchart. On the far left there, you'll see that we've added in inflation proofing, which essentially takes money from the ERA and puts it back into the permanent fund, at least under the structure proposed by the statutes. That's on the far left side there. Again, 145 doesn't end. More excitement. E, next slide, states that the legislature may not appropriate from the ERA to the general fund a total amount that exceeds the amount available for appropriation under 140B. Again, 145B is that 5% of the market value. E is a bit cryptic, but essentially authorizes money to go from the ERA to the general fund just in general. Moving on to F, F caps hypothetically, the amount that the legislature could expend from the ERA to go to the general fund and dividends, stating that the combined total transfer under B, again, that's the dividend transfer, and under E, again, the general fund transfer, cannot exceed the amount available for appropriation under B. Again, the amount for, available for appropriation under B is that 5% of the market value. We go to the next slide. Before returning to the flow chart, I just wanted to set out there is a remainder of 3713 that relates, again, mostly to the Permanent Fund Corporation, and I just didn't think it was worth the committee's time to go into detail here. More exciting, we can go back to the flow chart. So here we have a few more things to add in. We can see that the amount available for appropriation less the dividend appropriation is the amount that is potentially able to go into the dividend fund under the statutory formula. I thought it was also really important to circle back to the language of the Constitution here, which simply states, all income from the permanent fund shall be deposited into the general fund unless otherwise provided by law. This is the minimum constitutional requirement and is, in fact, the only appropriation requirement binding to the legislature. We can add a few more things to this slide if we click through to the next one. I know some members of the committee in the past have been interested in the historical, like how these statutes all got built on top of each other. And this is the first place that I'll mention there's a typo where it says 1992 in the blue brackets on the top right side. It should say 1982. You can cross that out. The top line, really, of this structure was the original dividend structure as set out in the 1980s, although one says 1986 and one is 1982. Those are sort of like technical revisions that happened. But the general structure of the permanent fund draws statutorily was set out in 1980 and was amended, sort of tweaked a few times after the United States Supreme Court in Zobel declared that the original structure of the permanent fund was unconstitutional because it favored residents who had stayed longer. The initial structure of the permanent fund had a payout that increased the longer a resident stayed in the state, and the Supreme Court found that was unconstitutional duration of residency requirement. And as a result, the legislature tweaked some of the initial permanent fund statutes to accommodate this new payout structure. So that said, we can think of the income available for distribution and the 50% multiplication of that amount as the statutory dividend program that was initially envisioned at the time the dividend program was enacted. The bottom line we can think of as SB 26. That's the new regime starting in 2018. And that set out the amount available for appropriation, a sort of new cap on the amount that could be drawn from the earnings reserve account, and also authorizing appropriations to go to the general fund. Does anyone have any questions so far?
No, I see none. Go ahead and continue.
All right. As I said, the permanent fund statutes are really divided into two different sections. So the next section we'll jump onto is 4323. We can start after the intro slide. There should be a list of slides that, or excuse me, of statutes that are not particularly worth discussing. The next slide after that would be the text of 4323025, which sets out the amount of the dividend, essentially stating that the amount of the dividend is the amount of money transferred to the dividend fund each year divided by the number of eligible applicants. There's a few other important statutes before we jump back to the flowchart on the next slide. Should be a portion of the text of 4323028. The principal concept here is that by October 1st of each year, the commissioner is required to give public notice of the value of each dividend to the public. And under 4323045, the dividend fund is established as a separate fund. It's administered by the commissioner and is invested in the same manner as the permanent fund. So going back to our flowchart, I think we're going to make some room here. So if we click to the next slide, we can see the calculation for the dividend itself. So we take the amount transferred to the dividend fund. There's a few adjustments that appear in the law. Divide that by the number of eligible individuals. And in general, according to the statutory structure, this is how we get the dividend amount per each individual. One common misconception I see is that if someone doesn't apply for their dividend, that money goes to the state. In fact, it does not. A decreasing number of eligible individuals increases the amount per individual. In other words, if you don't apply for your permanent fund dividend, that amount of money that you do not receive gets spread across all of the eligible applicants. Next slide. The next slide is the remainder of 4323. Again, I didn't find this particularly important to discuss in this presentation, so we can jump on to what is perhaps the most key piece of information in this presentation, which is an understanding of Wilikowski v. State. And I'm always amused when I have to give this presentation with Senator Wilikowski on the line. I always think that he should be the one discussing this. But essentially, the Wilikowski v. State case held that the revenue of the permanent fund is not exempt from the dedicated funds clause of the state constitution. So under Article 9, Section 7, the proceeds of taxes and revenues, which the Supreme Court under State v. Alex said included a broader spectrum of all state revenues, are available for appropriation each year unless there's a constitutional provision that says they're not. In other words, despite all the statutes that we just reviewed that said shall transfer or shall be appropriated, the legislature is free to appropriate the permanent fund income however it chooses each year, or as the court in Wilikowski v. State said, the dividend program must compete for annual legislative funding just the same as any other program. So if we click to the back again, the flow chart, we see there is this complicated statutory structure that sort of historically layered on top of each other and may conflict depending on the amount of money in the ERA or appear to conflict based on the statutory structure. But in fact, what the confines of the legislature are actually the Constitution, that it's not required to appropriate any money according to the statutory structure. For that reason, it's really important that we again continue to return to the Constitution, and the Constitution is very broad. It just says that the income of the permanent fund shall be deposited into the general fund, and from there it is free for the legislature to use for appropriation for any purpose, any public purpose, I should say. On to the next slide, which I believe is just my slide asking if anyone has any questions.
Any of the committeemen have a question here at the table? Senator Bishop.
I'd just like to thank Ms. Nauman for another great presentation, and they're getting better and better. I like the flow charts, and I think the people at home that take the time to go through it will get a better understanding, too, of how the calculation works. So good job.
Now to the senators online. Senator Wilikowski, Senator Olson, anyone here have a question?
No questions.
No questions from me, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you. Okay. Seeing no other questions, thank you very much for your presentation today. I know you're off to another meeting, so we appreciate you coming by. Thank you.
Thank you. Our office is always available to answer any questions by email or phone if anyone has any follow-up thoughts. Okay, it was a pleasure to join you today, and I'm sorry I couldn't be there in person.
Thank you. Okay, next up, we're going to have Mr. Alexei Painter, Director of Legislative Finance, come forward, along with Mr. Connor Bell, Fiscal Analyst at Legislative Finance. He'll come up, jump in the hot seat. What we've asked him to do is give us a historical look back on the permanent fund and the dividend flows and the values following the constitutional structure, mandated structure, without the arbitrary contributions and actions we've taken here in the legislature over time. And with that, if you can go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and then take us through the presentation, and we'll go back to our normal process where you can go do a slide, and then I'll see if there's any questions, and we'll go to the next one.
For the record, Alexei Painter, Legislative Finance Division. For the record, Connor Bell, Fiscal Analyst, Legislative Finance Division.
And so I'll start off the first couple of slides and then turn it over to Mr. Bell for the remainders. So just to sort of explain what we're doing here, we're doing a few historical scenarios with different assumptions, assuming different policy choices by the legislature in the past. And so these are hypothetical exercises and assume that everything but the particular change we're making did not change. And this is by nature sort of an approximate exercise. There have been numerous changes in the permanent funds accounting practices and in minor changes in statute and things like that that make it so it's difficult to necessarily reconstruct the permanent funds performance over the years. And so there's some margin of error on these. I would encourage people to view these as approximations. But I think Connor did a great job of trying to get the most reasonable answers we could. But I do want to just make sure everybody's aware that there is some uncertainty about the exact numbers here. And then I'll cover this slide quickly and then turn it over to Connor. So this slide shows where our current permanent fund balance came from, and this is as of June 30th of 2021, so the end of the previous fiscal year. And so each of these charts, or each of the slices of this pie chart represent a different source. So the 25% dedicated royalties that Ms. Nauman spoke of is $15.7 billion, or 19% of the permanent fund's value. The majority of the fund's value comes from other sources. The next is the statutory royalties, the additional 25% of new fields. In the 1980s, the legislature chose to appropriate $2.7 billion over a four-year period from the general fund to the permanent fund in addition to the required royalties. That $2.7 billion, while it's only 3% of the fund, because it was early on, actually represents a fairly large percentage of the fund's value, as we'll see in some of the subsequent slides, because inflation proofing was layered onto that $2.7 billion, and it happened very early in the fund's history. So while that seems like a small amount, it has a surprisingly powerful impact on the size of the fund. The next amount, the largest chunk right now, is inflation proofing, $18 billion, and this is the statutory inflation proofing. In addition, the legislature has appropriated amounts from the ERA beyond the statutory inflation proofing. That's 10% of the fund. That does not include the $4 billion that was transferred in FY22, effective July 1st, since this is reflects June 30. So, you know, the day after this slide represents, that number would go up by $4 billion. The next one, the next slice, is the unrealized balance. So money moves from the principal of the ERA, or principal of the permanent fund, to the ERA through the statutory net income calculation that Ms. Nauman covered. So income that has not yet been realized through that statutory net income, meaning paper value increases of investments, so real estate that's worth more than what we bought it for, or stocks that are worth more than what we bought it for, that's an unrealized gain until we sell that asset and realize it. And so based on current accounting rules, that unrealized balance is split proportionally between the principal and the ERA. So that last slice here of $4.6 billion. Combined, that unrealized balance just gets divvied up, but really doesn't belong fully in either category because it only exists on paper. As soon as those gains are realized, they'll go into the ERA. Until then, they're not really spendable because they are just exist only on paper. Next slice is the Amrata Hess settlement. There was a legal settlement in a number of years ago that part of the settlement decreed that part of the agreement was that the state would set aside this money and would not be used for dividends. It's currently designated for deferred maintenance through the Alaska Capital Income Fund. So the income on that $400 million creates about $27 to $30 million a year on average for deferred maintenance. Then the next is the realized ERA, so this is the amount that's available for appropriation. And then finally, the unrealized balance in the ERA, again, part of the ERA, not really able to appropriate. And so, you know, again, just to the bigger point here is that only 19% of the permanent fund actually consists of the constitutionally dedicated portion. The rest is here through a series of statutes and essentially, you know, choosing to leave money in the permanent fund. If we had just followed the Constitution, there would only be this $15.7 billion of royalties in there. And I'll turn it over to Connor for the next few scenarios.
Do we have any questions on the initial pie chart? Okay, any questions off online from Senator Wilikowski, Senator Olson?
No questions.
Okay.
No question from me, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you. Go ahead and continue.
For the record, Connor Bell, Legislative Finance. So we're focusing on two historical what-if scenarios. The first is assuming that we follow the Constitution and statutes only, but with no additional ad hoc actions. And the most significant of those is the final bullet, which is that the $2.7 billion that we appropriated from the general fund to the permanent fund between FY81 and FY85, we're assuming this scenario that never occurred. And as Mr. Painter mentioned, that's very significant because of the nature of compounding returns, where that $2.7 billion is generating somewhere around 11% returns on average. And even with some of that money being drawn, it has a market impact on, you know, the balance of the fund some 30 years later. And the other differences are most applicable to more recent years. We're assuming in this what-if scenario that the statutory PFD was paid in all years. In actuality, the statutory PFD, we're paid below the statutory PFD beginning in FY 2017. We're also assuming that statutory inflation proofing, that transfer is made annually, but no additional ad hoc transfers are made. So no transfers from the earnings reserve to the principal are made that are in excess of that inflation proofing transfer. And finally, we're assuming that constitutional and statutory royalty deposits are made annually. The constitutional royalty deposits have to happen no matter what, but the statutory royalty deposits have not been deposited every year in actuality, though that it's a relatively small amount comparatively.
Go ahead, continue.
The second what-if scenario is starting with all of those assumptions from the prior slide, with the additional assumption that the other 50% of income available for distribution was historically used annually to pay for government services. So as Ms. Nauman has described, the statute outlines income available for distribution, and that's the 21% of five-year statutory net income. Half of that amount goes to the statutory permanent fund dividend, and we're assuming here that that 50% goes to the statutory dividend, and the other 50% is used to pay for government services.
Okay. Have any questions on the structure? Sitting down at the table, any questions on the last two slides from the online senators?
None for me, Mr. Chairman.
Well, could you repeat that?
Yeah, none for me, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Go ahead and continue.
All right. Slide 6 shows how the permanent fund's total value would be different under these what-if scenarios. The blue line shows the status quo, meaning what actually happened historically. The red line is showing the first scenario if we follow the Constitution and statute only, and the green line is showing following those Constitution and statute only and also drawing that additional 50% of income available for distribution to government. And the blue line starts to diverge from the red and green line in the early 80s, and that's when that, in the status quo scenario, that's when those $2.7 billion of appropriations from the general fund to the permanent fund occur. and the gap between the blue line and the red line grows over time because of those compounding returns associated with the that initial higher balance. And the status quo balance grows faster than the other scenarios, or faster than the Constitution statute-only scenario, even though it's consistently paying higher PFDs up until FY 2017. And the green line is showing the other 50% to government. It starts to fall below that red line because in the earlier years, it is literally paying, or close to literally paying, twice as much out from the permanent fund, and that it becomes less than double over time since it's doing 100% of that amount for distribution, but it's 100% of a smaller fund which grows, which has less statutory net income.
Okay, seeing no questions, hearing no questions, go ahead, Senator Bishop.
Just a comment, so Connor, so the initial $2.7 billion deposit added $21 billion to the fund?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, correct. It would actually be more since it also contributed to higher permanent fund dividends. And so in these, I should also note that, you know, these amounts are, you know, rough approximations. But, yeah, essentially we estimate that the ending fund balance is, you know, $20 billion higher, and that's before accounting for the, you know, higher dividends that were paid in the meantime.
$21 billion over $2.7 billion investment.
Go ahead and continue.
All right, slide 7 shows how PFDs would have been different under these what-if scenarios. And as I mentioned, the status quo does pay consistently higher PFDs. That is up until FY 17, and the dotted blue line shows the calculated statutory PFD. So while we paid under the statutory amount, the dotted line is just showing for illustration what the actual calculated statutory PFD would have been, and all the other calculations for status quo are using the actual PFDs paid. And they follow the same trends generally, and the green line again is falling below since the calculation is the same, the equation, it's just the fund balance is smaller and there's less statutory net income earned on a smaller fund, and that's why the dividends are lower in that other 50% to government scenario.
Any questions on this? So if we would have taken the 50% out, the state, instead of letting it stay in their compound and only follow the Constitution, the dividend would be roughly in the ballpark of $1,100. Is that correct, the green line?
Chair Stedman, yes, that's correct.
Yeah. And we have any other questions on this? Okay, next slide.
Finally, this slide is showing how much of the permanent fund would have been drawn and spent on government services. And so the reason why the other 50% to government scenario is, you know, significantly lower in the last two slides is because this entire time it's been drawing money to spend on government services. And so, you know, these are totally different worlds. It's, you know, hard to really analyze them in isolation since so much would be different. But basically, this is showing it's the same amount every year as the statutory PFD draw, and that amount is going to fund government. And beginning in FY 2019, you see the red line and the blue line jut up, and that's when SB 26 took effect, which is the structured draw that Ms. Nauman spoke to, which is the 5% of the lagged five-year average fund balance. And these amounts are showing the POMV draw minus the amount drawn for the dividend. So the $2.4 billion in the status quo, that is the $3-some billion POMV draw minus the amount spent on the permanent fund dividend, or drawn for the, to the dividend fund. And the red line, we're also assuming that SB 26 takes place, and after accounting for a dividend, the leftover of the POMV draw would be less than $1 billion. In the other 50% to government scenario, just to note, we are assuming that SB 26 never occurs, and that we keep using that 50% of income available for distribution as our structured draw from the fund.
Any questions on this slide or the previous slides? Any questions from the senators online? Senator Olson, Senator Wilikowski?
No.
None from me, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. We've been talking about showing these calculations. We've talked about this for about a year here at the table and indirectly in other venues about what it would permanent fund would look like under different scenarios if we would have, in particularly, taken our 50%. The state would have taken its 50% and consumed it or reinvested it in another portfolio. What would the permanent fund look like today? So that was kind of the precursor of this presentation, just to put it in historical structure. Also, we've heard a lot of discussion and comments about following the Constitution and following the laws and so on and so forth. So that's another reason why we thought it'd be nice to look at what, if we followed the Constitution, what would it look like potentially as with a look back. So that was a basis for this presentation today. We thought it would bring some information that the members may want to consider in as we move forward over the next several days, weeks, and year to rewrite and restructure the dividend, or not, whatever folks want to do. Do we have any other final questions for Ledge Finance on this presentation today? Senator Bishop.
I'd just like to thank Mr. Painter and Ledge Finance for putting this together, and I think if you take time and look at it, it's very obvious that the legislature hasn't been stealing the money and reinvesting the money and not taking our 50%. And in the power of what $2.7 billion does in the early 80s and how that's compounded to $21 billion today, and we're all have got the wind in our sails and are back from that prudent investment from former legislators. So I hope 30 years from now that whoever's sitting at this table will think maybe we should, if we could put another $2.7 billion in today, what would that look like in 30 years? Because you read the pretext for starting the fund in the beginning, it's for now and for the future. And it's the prudent thing to do, to maximize our assets, because you're only going to get one Prudhoe Bay. And we got to listen to what our forefathers said when they created this fund.
Any other comments by committeemen? I hope, Senator Bishop said, in 30, 40 years from now, they look back at the $4.9 billion check behind Senator Bishop and the $4 billion that we put in this year. I hope it makes a big compounded difference also in the permanent fund. So we'll see how history will tell the tale of that. We won't be around to read it, but our descendants will be. Okay, so that concludes the meeting today. I'd like to thank Senate Finance, or Legislative Finance, for coming forward. I'll get with Senator Bishop for tomorrow's schedule, and we'll get it posted, but you can assume there'll be a meeting at 9 a.m. We are adjourned.